case thing. Hi, everybody. My name is Jennifer, I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Jennifer.
My sobriety date is April 17th, 1989. My home group is the Salisbury Group in Midlothian, Virginia. Or Midlothian. Because we are in Virginia, aren't we? I have a sponsor. My sponsor's sponsor. I think that's all the nitty-gritty. I'd like to thank Billy for asking me to come up here. And I'd like to thank Lynn for opening the meeting and Angie for riding up here with me. It was a beautiful day out today. I couldn't believe it, how pretty it was. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I remember always feeling different growing up. From the earliest I can remember, I can remember always feeling different. And I hate these pants I have on because I feel like my pockets aren't correct for speaking, so I'm struggling here. Let me move it on back, right?
Yeah.
But I can always remember feeling different right out of the gate. And I don't know when I took my first drink, but I know my parents had a lot of parties. I was raised in New York on Long Island. My dad was a police officer with the New York City Police Department, and my mom was a dance school teacher. And I'm the oldest of four. And we used to have a lot of parties. I can remember having a lot of parties as a kid. My parents would have a lot of parties. And some of them turned into drunk fests, what I would call drunk fests. And I'm almost certain that at some time when I was really young, I drank, but I don't remember when. The first time I do remember drinking, I was probably around 13 maybe, 13 or 14. Could have been younger than that. I know I started the green leafy substance in between 6th and 7th grade, whatever age that is, 12 maybe, 13. But I remember drinking Wide Mouth Mickey's on the golf course. You know, and I don't remember having any big aha moment, you know, at that point. I just remember it was something to do. And I remember being there with two other people. I couldn't tell you who they were. I want to say they were females, but I really don't remember. But I don't remember having any aha moment. But it must have done something because, you know, it seems like after that, I mean, I had periods in junior high school, you know, stealing liquor from my parents' liquor cabinet or bar. We had a bar in the house. Stealing liquor from their bar, and it didn't matter what was in it. You know, it was whatever the bottle and the concoction to fill in the little Tupperware thing. being raised in the house with a police officer, I got caught all the time. I just, you know, I couldn't do a whole lot without getting caught. You know, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, but at that age, it was a whole lot easier to get my hands on weed than it was to get my hands on alcohol. And I would smoke before I got to school, during lunch, after I had the munchie attack and ate lunch, you know, and then I would go home. And I'd go home with the eyes half-masked, and my mom and dad would always be like, "What's the matter with you? What's going on?" And when I used to go to school, you'd face the school, and then there was this hill. And anybody who smoked or drank or did whatever we were doing would be up on that hill. Well, lo and behold, you know, one of the school bus drivers, friends with my mom, so I remember coming home. It was right towards the end of ninth grade, and I came home, and my mom, you know, I walked in, and she, you know, grabbed me as I came in the door and sat me in the living room. And I was like, uh-oh, this doesn't feel right. I think I'm in trouble. And I was, because apparently somebody had seen me on that hill, that school bus driver, and called my mother. And so I did what I knew how to do, was I lied. I told her whatever she wanted to hear. You know, when she walked out of the room, I took what I had in my back pocket and stuck it down the front of my pants. And lo and behold, she came back and checked my pockets. See, because, you know, even back then, it was all about me. You know, I liked checking out. I liked not feeling. I always wanted to be in somebody else's family. I did not want to be in my own. there was, you know, I can't even honestly say there was that much abuse going on in my family. I think my parents did the best they can. They're not the reason I'm an alcoholic. Granted, there's folks in my family that drink just like I do and have drank just like I do. But as far as I know, nobody else have found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know my brother got here by way of a DUI years ago, never stayed. And he'll come in not double-fisted with alcohol, but triple-fisted anywhere he goes usually, which is kind of interesting. But so I'm in that living room, and I get grounded for the entire summer. I don't know what to do. Going to church with my parents, I was raised in the church. You know, I had a decent upbringing. They gave me anything I wanted. I didn't want for anything that I can remember. You know, and it wasn't like we had money hand over fist, you know. We were just normal middle America, you know. Dad worked, mom worked. You know, at times I had to, you know, babysit my brothers and sisters because I was the oldest. And, you know, and at that time I was getting in trouble a lot because, you know, they'd put me in charge to babysit. And, you know, I'd be out back or doing whatever, you know, getting high. And you know, they'd come home and I'm supposed to be in charge. And I never was in charge. And, you know, I remember my brother, my youngest brother doing the airplane around the house. I can't tell you how old he was, but, you know, of course he fell and he cut his head and I had to go to the hospital and blah, 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 and that was my fault. I was like, okay, cool. You know, but that's just the way it was. You know, that's just the way it was. I didn't like having that responsibility back then. And quite frankly, I don't really like it now either. You know, it's just the way I am. I don't, you know... Even today, I can throw temper tantrums or hissy fits, as I like to call it, because I want to have my own way, and I don't want to have to be in charge of nobody, and I don't have to do nothing. It's just, you know? So that I got grounded for that summer, so I had to find a way to get out of the house when I went into high school, so I decided to play field hockey. So I played field hockey, and everything back then, you know, I was athletic. I was gifted in sports. I was gifted in field hockey and softball. Softball was my passion, my love. I love that sport. I got halfway decent grades when school started. And the first, you know, my first, I can remember being in high school, my first math test or math quiz, you know, I, like, got 105, you know. That was the best I ever did because after that it was all downhill. Because, you know, it was like, oh, this is easy. I don't have to do anything. And so I would do just enough to get by. I don't remember ever bringing home a book when I was in high school, junior. I just don't remember ever studying. You know, they say alcoholics were gifted, and I truly, truly believe, not based on myself, but based on a lot of folks that I see come in these rooms. I mean, we've got talents and gifts like you wouldn't believe, but then we got that little itty-bitty problem over here, which when I pick up a drink, I have no earthly idea. I cannot tell you when I'm going to put it down. And this was even back in high school. I couldn't tell you when I was going to put it down. I was experiencing blackouts in high school. And for me back then, blackouts were fun. You know, you'd go to school, and one or two things would happen. They would tell you what you did, and it was really cool. And if you were in a blackout, you were like, damn, I missed it. But if they told you what you did and it wasn't really cool and you weren't in a blackout, well, man, I was in a blackout. I don't remember nothing. You know? It was just the way I operated. So... When I drank, I never knew. There was never enough to satisfy my appetite when it came to alcohol. If I was at a party, I'd leave, but I would rage your booze. You know, I remember being, this is in high school, it was New Year's Eve, and went to a New Year's Eve party, and I'm drunk, and then I end up at somebody else's house, and I remember they were, I want to say, feeding me, like I was like, yeah, give me another drink, whatever. They were grasshoppers or something. And I was toasted. And then I had to go babysit at like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, and I show up drunk as a skunk, just having a grand old time with my mother, one of my mother's best friends. Never ever thinking that, man, these people are going to leave me with their children. But they did. I must have just passed out. But, you know, I was a mean drunk. I was a puker at times, but I really liked to drink and fight. That was my, like I said, I never knew when I was going to put it down. So, I mean, the joke was when we started out somewhere, you know, go ahead and get the keys from Jennifer first, because if you don't get the keys from her, she's going to fight you. Well, I get out of high school and I go to college on a full ride field hockey scholarship, which I thought was a joke because the only reason I played hockey was to get out of the house because I got grounded that summer. So I decided to play field hockey to get out the house. Now I'm very lazy, and it's very apparent because when I started out for that field, tried out for that field hockey team, I decided to be a goalie because there was no way I was going to run up and down that field with sticks. I was like, no way, that's too much work. See, I want the easier, softer way in whatever I do. Whatever I do, I want the easier, softer way. And I still want to look good, though, while I'm doing it. So I go to college on a full-ride field hockey scholarship, and I don't last. Lasted 2.5 years. And if you'd asked me a long time ago what happened, I would tell you I quit because I got scared, which is true, because I was drinking way too much. And I started hitting things like big trees. You know, I played field hockey for this college, and they made me do things in order to earn that education, and I didn't want to do them. You know, I didn't want to have to run to the field hockey field. So they had to assign somebody to run with me to make sure I could get there. You know, I was real quick to live off campus because that's where the party was. But I started not going to school, and I started just staying at home. And I basically flunked out because I stopped going to classes. And I truly believe the reason I flunked out is because I couldn't stop drinking. And when I can't stop drinking and I start to get afraid, I do the only thing that I know to do, and is I call my family. And I either call my father or I call my brother. But on this occasion, I called my aunt for some reason, my mother's sister, and then I called my brother. And sure enough, I came home and I quit school. But I was flunking out anyway. It didn't matter. So then I go back and I live with my parents, and I have just enough taste of freedom. And I don't want to follow their rules. And they owned the store, and they used to trust me to work at their store, and I would doctor their books so that I would have cash to go out at night. And then I would start going out at night, and I would tell my parents that I was going over here when in reality I was going over here, you know. And there would be times where I just wouldn't call. They wouldn't hear from me. I would leave at 4 or 5 o'clock. Hell, they would see me in the morning. I'd work at the store, and I'd go out after the store. They'd think I was one place. I'd end up another place. 2 or 3 days later, I would finally call. And it is an awful feeling when you call and you find out your dad's been put in the hospital. Can't even tell you today why, but, you know. And you don't know what, like, I can remember thinking, you know, I can remember feeling awful, but it's like, why do I do this? You know, like, I didn't have any responsibility in it at all. You know, it wasn't me. I didn't do nothing. I was just out having a good time. You know, and that's how I thought. That was my thought process. I didn't care. I didn't care about you, me, anybody else. No, I cared about me. I just didn't care about you. I cared about what you had, and I wanted what you had. If I had to steal it, I would steal it. You know? So through a series of events, I end up in Richmond, Virginia. And while I'm in Richmond, Virginia, you know, I'm not here a week. It's another geographic follower relationship. I end up in Richmond, Virginia, you know, not even a week, and I'm hanging with, you know, partiers, hardcore parties. We seem to find each other. I don't know how. We're like magnets. We just find each other, you know, and I'm partying, and I'm working, and I'm in this relationship, and you know, and I'm going out, and I start having an affair, and it's like, if I'm too, here's my thought process, and I today can still remember where I was sitting, drinking, and the thought came to me, well, if I'm 2 hours late, or if I'm 10 hours late, what does it matter? I'm late. So which do you think I did? Do you think I picked up the phone? No. Did I care? No. 10 hours later, I show up at the door. That's what I do, because I don't care about you. I don't care. You know, that's what alcohol does for me. It makes me not care in a major way. It makes me not, you know, I miss appointments. You know, I was scheduled to go into the Navy. because I had to find something to do, because living at mom and dad's and working in their fruit store was not working for me. And you know, and I didn't have the wherewithal to go back to school, even though I was trying. But I never, in everything I started, I could just never quite get over that hump to finish. So I end up in Richmond, and I just got lost. Where was I? I just, like, tangented bad. Like, woo! Went, oh, well, but this was before I even ended up in Richmond. But at one point, I decided I was going to go in the Navy. Well, it was like I had to go for the medical part of it, because I passed the test. Like I said, alcoholics were not stupid. Flying colors passed their ABSVAB or whatever they call that test. I passed that test. Flying colors, pretty much go wherever I want, do whatever I want, be whatever I want, as they say. And the night before my physical, I think I was turning 21, so I was partying and, you know, slept right through it. There went that. That decision was out the tube. But anyway, I end up in Richmond, and I'm trying to find a job, and I don't know what to do. And I get hired. I don't know how I get hired, to be honest with you. But I get hired at a pretty decent place. And it's a lot of fun. It's a job that I love. And I've loved it for years when I'm doing parts of it that I really love. There are other parts that I hate. But so I get hired on this job, and you know, they give me a whole bunch of authority with this job. And they give me a gun, and they give me a badge, and they tell me, whoop, you've gone through the academy, rock on. Mind you, when I was going through the academy, it was a big party. And, you know, two things are significant when I was going through the academy. One was when I went to get my picture for my ID badge. I was told to chew the piece of gum and not open up my mouth by my friends. Because if I had opened up my mouth, I was still reeking alcohol. Actually, I think I was still a little bit on the, you know, when you've pretty much drank all night, you might have slept 30 minutes to an hour, you get up and you're still rolling. That's about where I was that morning, you know. And then there was another time where they, you go for the, they teach you how to do the breathalyzer. And when they teach you how to do the breathalyzer, half the class gets drunk one day and half the class gets drunk the next day. Well, I can't remember which half I was in, you know, but, you know, this is the type of alcoholic I am. I'm like, wow, they're going to let me drink. You know, and I already know that they don't have enough alcohol. I'm not going to get drunk enough for this, you know. So what do? I start drinking beforehand. You know, and then they tell us we could bring alcohol if we want to bring our own alcohol. Well, I'm an alcoholic. Bring the Bacardi 151, you know, like, because I'm going to party, you know. You're giving me permission to get drunk. And sure enough, I got drunk, and, you know, it's kind of funny because we come out smelling like a rose, you know, on numerous occasions, you know, just no consequences. And they couldn't understand why my BAC was so high. And I couldn't tell you what it was, but it was way past what the, like, you know, you can have a drink and your BAC is supposed to be here, and you have another drink and now it's supposed to be here. And mine was off the charts. And I felt like I was fine. Like, what's the problem? You know? And so, of course, I get called down. Then they have to find somebody to give me a ride home because they won't let me drive. And I'm like, what do you mean? The party's just starting. You know? Why I still have this job with these same people is beyond me, but I do. Thank God. And I always had the ability to talk myself out of anything. And when I was drinking, that was a good thing. But while I am sober, it is a hindrance. See, because I think I have all the answers. And I think that if I can lie or cheat or steal my way out of something, even today, I might just try that little itty-bitty lie. Not like when I first got here, but even today, my first thought, my son, 2 weeks ago, a week ago, was shooting a BB gun. And he aimed it at the direction of a house, not where I asked him to aim it. And he broke this big window. And my first thought after this window breaks, and it's a double pane, mind you, it's a double pane window, is let's just clean out the glass. Now my house is sold. Contract signed. We close on May 18th. Let's just clean out the glass. It's a double pane. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal today is I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I did that. However, that is still the first thought that pops into my head. Like, what's wrong with that? You know? But I can't do that. Anyway, so I'm in Richmond, and I'm working this job, and I'm scared to death. And every waking moment, I'm thinking about, when am I going to get a drink? Where's the next drink going to be? I mean, that's what we did. You know, like, where was the party? Were we going to, we get off at 2 a.m.? Were we going to go party? You know, and it amazed me. We get off at 2 a.m. and we go to what they call the choir practice, and we'd be down by the river, and, you know, we'd be shooting guns down by the river, and they'd be calling across the river, like you could see the police cars riding up and down because they'd get the permission of shooting calls, and it's us on the other side of the river shooting into the river. I was a really good shot, too, when I was drunk. I could never figure that out. I just was, and they could never figure it out. You know, but, like, little things started happening back then. There was this guy that I met when I was, must have been at field training, and he was undercover. And I met him at an accident scene. Because he called in an accident, and my training officer was there, and it was kind of like, well, he's undercover, he's one of us, blah, 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 blah. So now, fast forward a few years down the road, this is right before I tank out, bottom out. A few years down the road, him and I are at a party, and we're at one of these choir practices, and, you know, we're partying, and I can't remember. I know I'm drinking. Now, am I doing anything else? I couldn't tell you. Odds are, probably, but I don't really remember. Well, he sits me down because he's been undercover, and he says, you know, you really, really need to stop doing what you're doing because you're going to get caught. And when you get caught, you're going to lose your job. And for whatever reason, I heard that. So I stopped doing that stuff they test you for, and I just pretty much drank and go about my merry way. Don't really think anything of it after that. So however long it takes me after that, I go on a 3-day binge, and I end up showing up for work on a Sunday morning. This is April 15th, 16th. I guess it's the 16th. I show up at work, and sunglasses on, newspaper, chocolate milk, because I'm really hungover, because I've pretty much been on a 3-day binge, two 3-day binge, and I show up for work. And why I was blessed with the ability to show up for that job is beyond me. Because, you know, I had already started getting suspended for coming in late. You know, I was already gotten suspended for having to be at work at 5 o'clock in the morning for this big stakeout, but I was too drunk. I mean, I distinctly remember starting a party the night before and never got there. You know, when I show up, it's 9 a.m. And then, they're writing me up and putting me on report. And I'm like, why are you putting me on report? I was just late. Well, because you were supposed to be there. See, because I don't like to follow rules and I don't like to have to be on time. So, I mean, I was already starting to have some consequences. And so I go into work that day. I'm really hungover. And I lasted, I remember getting there at 10:30. I was out by noon. By 3 o'clock, I was sitting in a bar, watermelon shooters and beer. And I like the sweet stuff. Give me peppermint schnapps on ice with a straw. That was my fave. Why, I don't know, but I just really liked it. And have a hard time drinking peppermint today, like if it was like peppermint mochas. I can go through periods where I can drink them, and then it's like, no, I can't do the peppermint. So I'm in this bar. The version that I remember is coming to at a red light and then continuing on, blowing through the red light, getting to where I was going and doing what I did there. But what happened at the bar before I left is I went after somebody with a pool cue, gave a woman who actually works for me today a black eye, and got thrown out of the bar pretty much. And and I wanted to say, no, that didn't happen, because I had other blackout prior to that. And then to this day, I still don't believe that I did what they say I did, which was went in and destroyed this bathroom. I just can't even comprehend that blackout at all. I'm like, I don't believe you. But they swear it's me. And I'm like, why wouldn't it be me? My history, if I look back on my drinking, it shows that, yeah, it was probably me. So that happens at the bar. I'm on the phone threatening. I end up at this person's house. I try to run them over with my car. I bit them, which is a felony. And next thing I know, lo and behold, those people. people that I work with are throwing me on the back of a police car. And you know what I do? I go right into my, oh my God, I'm so sorry, it'll never happen again speech. You know? So they take me from that location, and they pull me up the street, and, you know, and they do what we do best at times, which is help somebody out or cut them a break. And, you know, and in the profession I'm in, sometimes that courtesy goes a long way, and sometimes it doesn't. I'll be honest with you, sometimes it doesn't. But it went that way my night at that point. And they called my partner, and my partner came and got me, and we went back to my house. I didn't have my house keys. And I only remembered this part of the story a few years ago. It hadn't even been that long. Apparently, I went over to my neighbor's to use the phone to get the keys to my car, and I made a complete ass out of myself. Just drunk, just isn't, you know, not that I am in a world of trouble at work already, but isn't life great? The party is still happening, you know, we're still, so we go back to the city-county line, and, because I live in the county, and we're in the 7-Eleven, and it's 11:45, so it's still early. In my mind, I'm like, woohoo, 7-Eleven, still serving beer. And my partner, I remember standing in the aisle, and she's saying to me, Jennifer, you don't really want to do this. You know, little did I know, and this is my work partner, I had no idea her husband had been in the program, and actually I just saw him a couple weeks ago, and he's been sober like 26 years or so. But I had no idea back at that time that he was in the program. No idea. And I would show up at his house on Sunday mornings with a beer in my hand while he worked on my car, and he never said a word, you know. And I'd walk out of my house with my beer, my neighbor would be washing his truck, and I'd be like, so what's wrong with this picture? Not, I always have a beer in my hand, but why is he washing his truck so early on a Sunday morning? You know, I just didn't see it. Just didn't see it. Didn't want to see it. So anyway, she doesn't let me get that beer, which I remember being really pissed because I didn't have any alcohol at the house because they'd already taken it out of my house in another episode. And so I go back to my house, and, you know, and I do what we do at times is I obsess and I compulse till I pick up the phone, and I start threatening to kill somebody, and kill the person, kill the kids, kill the new person, kill everybody. And just kill them all. I'm whacked. So, you know, I'm all mouth, and I will be all mouth probably to the day I die, unless God really helps me at times. But, you know, I do what I know best is I start to threaten and manipulate and con and do whatever I can do because, you know, I'm in a world of trouble and I want you back. And the only thing I can see is that I want you back. I don't see that I've been stalking you for the last 6 months. I just want you back. I don't understand why I can't have you back. Maybe I drink just a tad bit too much, but what's the problem? I don't see that as the big deal. Well, of course, I get on the phone, I pick up the gun, I put the gun to my head, and the next thing I remember is the gun's going off, but it's going off towards the floor, and I shoot the floor of my house 3 times. Now, today I find that fascinating that, you know, if you've ever been underneath the house and there's pipes and stuff, that I didn't hit anything. But I didn't. But I always wanted, you know, like there was no big water. Anyway, I shoot up my house, and when you do what I do and you shoot up your house, they kind of don't think that's really cool, especially when you're on the other line. You know, you're on the phone with somebody and they can hear the gun going off, you know, and then you're like, I can't believe I'm laughing about this because it's really, like, sad. But you're just being silent, like, I mean, just, that's nasty. That is flat out nasty. But that's what I'm capable of. You know, that is what I am capable of. And I finally did speak, though. And they called the police, and then, you know, the police surround my house. The poor county guy sprained his ankle in my backyard. I felt bad for about a split second. I mean, and they came, you know, they call me on the phone, right, and I answer the phone, and they're like, okay, where's your gun belt? And I'm like, I don't know, it's in the bedroom or something. They're like, go get it. So I get the gun belt. They're like, where's the gun? I'm like, right here on the table. They're like, okay, holster. I can't remember if they made me empty it or holster it, but I had to do something. And they were like, okay, open the front door slowly. Drop it out on the steps. You know, I laugh about it today, but these people still employ me, which is absolutely a blessing. Absolutely a blessing. So so I do all that, and then the next thing you know, I've got people that are pretty high up, and where I was a peon at that point in my career, these people are sitting in my living room watching a Texas A&M college baseball game on ESPN, while the internal affairs investigator is, like, looking at the house and doing all the stuff. And, you know, and this is how sick I am. The thing I think about is sitting at the kitchen table, and they're all in the other room, and, like, the guns there, the gun belts there, the bullets there. And thank God, you know, it was a fleeting thought to blow them all away. Because I think had I been in my, you know, I mean, had I really, really been tanked, or had I really, really, you know, whatever, you know, I truly, truly believe, and it's a scary place to be when you're newly sober and you come to this, that I have the capacity to kill somebody. And not with that weapon they give me, but with my own bare hands. That's a scary place. But that's kind of what went through my head sitting there that night. So the next day I go in and, you know, they leave like at 4 o'clock in the morning. They made me show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, to the big guy, one of the big guys, you know. And they decide that week that they're going to send me to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I can't remember which one. See, but I already been seeing a counselor because that, you know, that relationship that had split up, I couldn't deal apparently. And, you know, so I was already seeing somebody. But they didn't want to send me to him. They wanted to send me to somebody else. And I manipulated that, too. I was like, no, I want to go to him. He's a city psychologist. He's the one I want to see. Because I figured he kind of knew what was going on. And at this point, my only thought was, don't lose that job. That's the only thing I got. Don't lose that job. And so that's what I went after, not losing my job. And I finally got to see him on a Wednesday, and I sat in his office, and I said, you know, because he was like, okay, do you really want to kill yourself? Because apparently I was threatening suicide. And I was like, no, I don't want to die. You know, and it's almost like, this is how bad I am. I'm, you know, like, what would make you think I wanted to die? You know, that's, like, come on now. I got a little too drunk, you know. But I said to him, and thank God he heard it, what I said was, I really need to find a hobby because everything I do, I have a beer in my hand. And that was the God's honest truth. Everything I had a beer in my hand. And the reason I had a beer in my hand was because I had already went through all the mind games of, well, I can't drink liquor because I get really mean, or if I drink Black Russians, I'm going to really fight you, or, you know, tequila, kamikazes, how do you say that?
Kamikazes
send me over the edge. I mean, like, really out there, you know, and of course I love that. See, because that was part of my facade or part of my thing. The crazier I was, you know, that's how I got my attention. You know, if I could be just a little bit more crazy than you were, like, I'll jump out of that tree into that pool from, like, the roof of this building. What's the, you know, anything for attention. You know, look at me. Hello, me. So, anyway, I say that to that man, and he ends up, that Friday, I go to an intake because they're going to try to put me in a treatment center that's no longer around, I don't think. And the woman, thank God for her, she had 8 years sobriety. And I remember sitting there. Now, this is when I really knew that I was an alcoholic, but I did not know it at the time. It took years for me to remember this and years for me to realize this is truly, I am truly, truly an alcoholic. The woman says to me, now, mind you, I have not had a drink in a week. Not from Monday, Sunday night until Friday, so 5-day week, business week. I haven't had a drink. I got a dog, but I haven't had a drink because I had to do something. See, because I was going nuts. I was already going nuts, and I was afraid to drink because if I drank, I was afraid I was going to pick up that gun and blow my head off. That was my fear. And she says to me, we don't know if my insurance is going to cover it. And she says to me, well, since you haven't had a drink, you know, since Monday or Sunday, we're probably going to have to give you a six-pack, get a six-pack, and you're probably going to have to drink so you have alcohol in your breath. And I remember today sitting there and the sweat. I got scared. See, because I knew right then, I was like, no, lady, you don't understand. A six-pack's not enough. I knew that. I knew that sitting right there. I didn't know what that fear was all about at the time, but I know today that a six-pack absolutely would not have been enough. And I also knew, because I had been starting to see the pattern there, whether I wanted to see it or not, was I didn't know what was going to happen when I picked up that drink. I had no idea, and that was starting to scare me. You know, and the point of that last time I had picked up a drink, you know, I had threatened to pick up that gun on numerous occasions. I would wake up and find it, you know, it was a revolver, so it would be, you know, empty, the whatever that cylinder would be, whatever. And I don't know much about guns, even though people think I do. It's just something, it's something I need to use at work. Well, the handcuffs would be all wrapped around it, so, you know, and I'd be getting ready for work, and it'd be like, where's the key? And I'd be going, you know, because the night before, apparently in a blackout, I got afraid, and I locked that gun up, so I wouldn't do anything with it, you know. This is also towards the period where, you know, I started showing up at the hospitals because I kept hitting stuff, you know, and was I going to the hospital? Can you give me something for the pain? Did my hand really hurt? No. Did I get stuff for the pain? I can't remember. To be honest, I have no idea what they did. I think they just wrapped my hand, and then I could get out of work, and I could go in and go, look at me, poor me, you know. So this woman, we can't get, I don't have to drink the six-pack of beer. We can't get me into treatment, and it's a Friday night, and she takes me to an AA meeting. She took me to Greenwood Commuter Meeting in Richmond, Virginia, at St. Matthew's. And I remember when I walked in, you walked in, I don't know if anybody here remembers it or has been there at that church, but you walked in and there was a stage. When you walked in the door, there was a stage, and you kind of walked down some steps into a dark kind of basement-y sort of room. This one's a little bright. You walk down in the room, and the window shades are on the wall with the steps and the traditions, and you go over into the kitchen, and I don't know what to do. And she says, you want a cup of coffee? Okay. And I didn't really drink coffee, but I'll have a cup of coffee, you know. And I sit down in the seat, and the woman in front of me, you can smell the alcohol on her. See, and back then, I was just appalled that she would have been drinking an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Today, why wouldn't somebody who has been drinking come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? That's what we are, you know. We're a bunch of drunks. Some people get here drunk. Some people get here without a drink. So I'm sitting there smoking like a fiend, and I'm like, wow, everybody here is addicted to coffee and cigarettes. But what I remember the most is the first man opens up his mouth for the topic or whatever, and he starts talking. He brings up the topic of gratitude, and he starts talking about his daughter. Well, I believe it was his daughter, and about getting to see her. She was 9 years old, and he was getting to see her for the first time in a year, see, because he was picking up his year chip. And he talked about how different his life was. And for that split second, I had just that much hope that, wow, man, you know, maybe, just maybe. I didn't know if this would work for me or not, but just maybe. But I knew for that 1 hour that I was there, I felt better. Something about being there, I felt better. And what this woman did for me also was she set me up with another person to go to another meeting on Sunday. This was a Friday, on Sunday. You know, so she went that little bit of extra step to try to get me to another meeting. See, because a lot of people, they come to their first meeting and they don't come back. You know, she'd already set me up for another one. Well, in the meantime, I went to one Saturday because I had nothing to do. And my sister and brother were at the house and they were drinking. And I was like, okay, I got to do something. See, because I got to keep my job. And I'll do anything to keep my job. And if you tell me I have to go to these meetings to keep my job, then that's what I'll do. I can do that. I can do it. You know, that's easy. I can go to these meetings. But something inside of me, I was like, these meetings ain't too bad. You know, so I started going to meetings all the time. And at about 9 months sober, I was still hanging out with people that I work with and people that drank. And I went to a party, and it was December 16th. And right around December 16th. And they were drinking, and I walked in, and there was, you know, alcohol on the counter, and there was alcohol cider on the stove, and it smelled good, and I freaked out, completely freaked out. And I called my sponsor, and I was back home within 30 minutes on my knees asking God to remove my obsession to drink, because I was scared. Because by that time, I didn't want to drink. I wasn't coming here to save my job anymore. I was coming here because I knew I was an alcoholic. And what I started to hear, you know, I can remember going into a meeting and I would hear people say I'm an alcoholic and an addict. So I am, Jennifer, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I had no idea what that meant. But I wanted to fit in. I wanted so bad to fit in somewhere. What I know today is that I'm an alcoholic and that I'm not an addict. When it was time to put down that other stuff, I put it down. You know, that stuff enhanced my drinking. It could help me to drink a lot longer. You know, and even that was the control thing, you know. If I do that, then I can drink. Or if I drink, then I can't do that because I would get sick at times. And But I knew at that point I wanted to stay, and I wanted to stay here. I wasn't real sure what the steps were about, but I had gotten a sponsor, and we tried to work the steps. And I worked the steps with that woman, and she taught me things like, you know, to get on my knees in the morning, to put shoes under the bed, to remind me to get on my knees in the morning, and then to take them out, or put shoes under the bed at night, to get on my knees, to thank God for helping me stay sober. And then when I got up in the morning and I took my shoes out from under the bed, was to get back on my knees and ask God to help me stay sober just today. You know, and I started to do that stuff. You know, for step two, what she had me do was she had me take a piece of paper. And on that piece of paper, I had to draw a line. And I had to write down what I thought God was and what I wanted God to be. And what I thought God was and what I wanted God to be were two entirely different things. See, because what I thought God was that God that I was raised in that church, and he wore the robes, and he had the beard, and he had the staff, and he was, and if you don't do, lightning is going to strike, because that's what my mother told me. And as a kid, I trusted my mother, and I trusted my father, and that's what they told me. And that's what I would hear week after week after week when I was brought to church. Not that that was a bad thing, mind you, but I was afraid of that God that I came in here with, because I thought for sure I was going to get struck by lightning. See, because I didn't walk the same path that a lot of people did. You know, and I was different in some respects. But I wasn't different in the respect of that I'm an alcoholic. When I pick up a drink, I have no earthly idea what's going to happen. I lose total control. You know, and I knew that. And that's where we have that common bond. And if we have that common bond, the only solution I know is the common solution, which comes out of the text of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it says here that there is a solution. So for step two, what my sponsor did after I had that list, you know, because the God I wanted was a God that was forgiving, because I had done a lot of shit. I was afraid. I had done a lot of stuff, you know, and I was afraid. I was scared to death, you know. I was in a job where they gave me that authority, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, but they're entrusting me to do it. But yet, you know, I've done some things where, by rights, I shouldn't have that job, you know. I wanted my God to be loving. I wanted my God to be all-powerful, you know. I wanted the forgiveness and the loving are two of the big things. But I still have that list, and it's funny, I got here and I was like, where's my big book? I forgot my big book. Mind you, I'm moving, so God only knows where it is. I think it's at the old house. Anyway, because I'm not finished moving yet. But so that's what we did for step two. And she took that piece of paper and she tore it down the middle and she threw that half that what I thought God was away. And she said, here's your new higher power. This is what you're praying to. You know, and after a few years, I've added to that list, you know, because I sell myself short on any list I write in this program, because my God is all powerful and is amazing. And when I have my plan or scheme or design on it, I sell myself short. You know, it says in the other book that Bill Wilson wrote a while ago, after this book, I think it was in the 50s, in the 12 and 12, you know, he talks about not letting the good be the enemy of better and best. And I always settle for good because still I can want the easier, softer way, you know, because I'm afraid and I don't want to trust. Because God forbid I trust, you know, that means I might have to let go of some of that control. You know, and I want to have my hands in stuff so that I can manipulate that outcome. So that's what we did. You know, we got to step three, and I got on my knees, and I said the third step prayer that was in the big book, you know. And I've had several experiences with that, and one experience was I felt like I was actually walking off the ground, and I could feel that power, you know. I could feel that power, and I want that power. See, because when I step out of the way, my higher power does amazing things. Like, I shouldn't be in the job that I'm in today. There's no way, not with my past. My family shouldn't speak to me based on what I've done to them in the past, but they do. You know, people, this girl that works for me that I gave a black eye, which I know is true because I saw it 3 days later. It was a nice shiner, by the way, and we kid about it today. But, you know, she shouldn't be working for me. You know, it's amazing how things happen. So we did step four, you know, and I went through the rest of the steps, and I'm running out of time, so I want to tell you some of the other things that I did. You know, I went back and I got that education. I couldn't have done that by myself. There's no way. I hate school. I've always hated school. Because there's rules, and they tell me what I have to do, you know? But somehow, I got a degree. It hangs on the wall, which is a really nice piece of paper, and, you know. But I did it. You know, I followed through on something. I finished something. You know, somewhere along the way, I decided that I want a child. And I have a beautiful 11-year-old son and who means the absolute world to me and has never seen me drunk, you know, has never seen me drunk. You know, at 12 years sober, I wanted to kill myself. I got to a point at 12 years where I wanted to eat my gun. And it's because I had stopped working the steps, and I had stopped coming around. You know, and at 12 years, I went to a meeting, and this woman was talking about the big book, and she was like, sober 16 years, and she was like, all the answers in the big book. I'm like, no way. So I talked to her, and I ended up at a big book study. And, gee, a big book study, what a concept. But I ended up at a big book study. And, you know, and it saved my life. It saved my life. You know, because I let, you know, getting that education, I let getting that child, I let getting that relationship, I let getting that material stuff. God, I can't think of it. And it's like so blazing for me. That material stuff get in the way, you know. And I had gotten away from the program at Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's humbling. You know, I've bought and sold houses in this program like it was just something to do. And worked myself up into a world of debt. And I'm in the process of renting, like moving this weekend, renting a house. And, you know, I sat in his house last night and I was like, thank you, God. You know, thank you, God. I couldn't have asked for a better place to live. You know, my son, I wanted my son to be in the same school district. See, because I had to sell my house because I got in a world of debt and I couldn't afford to live there, you know. And I don't want to come in and tell you that because I can still get caught up in that power prestige and how can I be sober this long and still not be able to or blah, 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 blah. You know, the committee, just keep going. See, I'm a thinker, man. I want to, boom, details, think, get it all, Well, I thunk myself right into debt, like major debt, you know, because I wanted to fill that hole. Because I don't want to trust. Because I can still be afraid to trust that higher power that they talk about in this book. But what I'm starting to learn is that, you know, the folks in the rooms can keep me sober for a little while. I can trust y'all. And I can trust my sponsor. And I can do what my sponsor says. But when the rubber meets the road and my behind's on fire, I best have a higher power. Because if I don't have a higher power, there's a good possibility I might drink. You know? And there is somebody near to and dear to my heart. Wow. Oof. Oof. Near and dear to my heart that has recently gone out. And she's like a daughter to me. You know? And there was nothing you could tell her. There's nothing we could say. You know? And her son and my son were like best friends. You know, and I've watched her son change. I watched her change. And she got caught up in with finding that, you know, that relationship or whatever. And started going out, and sure enough, she drank, you know. And I try to look at it today, you know, the blessing was, you know, when she needed to talk to somebody and tell somebody, she didn't call her sponsor, she called me. And I was like, you know, on one hand, I want to choke her through the phone. But on the other hand, I have to thank God, you know, because but for the grace of God, that could be me, you know, and I forget that. I can forget that time and time again, you know. Why do I have a built-in forgetter? I don't know. I get caught up in life, you know, and life starts to show up, and I want to do what I know to do, which is the easier, softer way. Well, today, you know, I got to break that cycle, and that's, you know, so I'm renting a house, and it's probably going to be, I mean, I'm excited about it, I've never done that before, or I've done it before, but long before I got sober, you know. My career, you know, I've been promoted twice, and I also have the opportunity to say, you know what, getting promoted again is not a good idea right now, and to be able to say no and know you make the right decision. My parents are getting ready to come into town, and my mother's fairly ill. Some of y'all already know this, but my mom's fairly ill, and it's tough. It's tough stuff. Tough stuff when your parents are ill. Whether you like your parents or not, it's still tough stuff. You know, but I don't have to pick up a drink. You know, I don't have to pick up a drink. I try to do the 11th step every morning and every night. And, you know, the first 15, 16 years of my sobriety, I would get up here and lie to you and tell you that I tried to do the 11th step morning and night. And it was the fly by night. It was touch down on my knees and go, run and do what I needed to do, get home and touch down on my knees again and go to bed. And today I try to slow down a little bit and I try to read and do exactly what it says in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life is changing. You know, my life is changing. To be able to go through some of the things that I've been through recently with selling houses and moving and my mother being sick and my job and just, you know, thank God for this program, you know, because if I didn't have this program, I truly, truly, honestly, in my heart of hearts, believe that I wouldn't be here, because I believe at some point I would pick up that gun, and if I was to do that, you know, I can't even imagine what my, it's funny, because with my friend drinking, it's amazing how many people, we were talking about this last night or the night before, how many people that affects. Absolutely amazing how many people that affects. And what that has pretty much told me is, dang, how many lives did I affect when I picked up a drink or I didn't make that phone call, you know? Somebody said it, you know, last night or the night before, you know. The reason I don't usually or want to do what's been suggested or not want to do what's in this book is because my path becomes super duper narrow. It becomes super duper narrow. But you know, and I used to be told that all the time about the spiritual path is a narrow path, and I never ever understood that. You know? But for me today, all that means is trying to be the best Jennifer that I can be. Because that's all I can be. I can't be the best Billy. I can't be the best my son. I can't be the best mom. I can't be the best police officer. I can't be the best friend. I can't be none of that stuff unless I'm the best Jennifer that I can be. And what I am starting to find out, if I'm just the best Jennifer that I want to be, you know, that I can be, if I get up every day and I am the best Jennifer that I can be, then that little voice that says, you're a bad mom, seems to disappear. That little voice that says, I can't believe they pay you this much and give you this job, seems to disappear. And I don't seem to obsess about myself anymore. Because it says in the book time and time again that my sobriety depends entirely on constant thought of others and what I can do to help somebody else. So when the phone rings and I don't want to answer it, I have to answer that phone. When somebody calls, and, you know, in my mind, I want to go to the meeting with my girlfriend and I want to spend 2 hours with her and I don't want anybody else going with us. And when the phone call comes and this person's having a really hard time, I say, yep, go ahead, tell her to come. What time do we need to pick her up? You know, because I know that if I do the other thing, if I do what I want to do, that's good. Yeah, that's going to be good. But if I do that, I'm standing in the way of better and great. You know, the best and great. And I truly, truly believe that today. But if I just step out of the way long enough. I want to thank you again for having me. I think I'm done. I love y'all. It's good to see a lot of you.